Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing pretty good, Justin.
Awesome. Good to see you again.
Yeah, it's been a little bit, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. I'll talk about my adventures some other day. We don't have time tonight. We have some thank yous to do.
Well, and some updates. For anyone who's missed it, we have several lines of new merchandise.
Oh, yeah.
New designs, new items. And we also have our fourth premium episode. Again, premium episodes, they're donation episodes. Donate some money, you get the episode. We do put work into them. The latest one is advocacy, and it was Justin's idea, and we think it turned out pretty good, so you might want to check that out. Go to genypod.com. That's genwhypod.com.
And for anyone that wants to hear the Juan interview we did, it's going to be out on the shop too.
For free. Now, tonight's episode concerns the unsolved murder of Kim Thomas.
The comedian Tom Stover suggested this episode. He's a really funny guy. His website's tomstovercomedy.com.
And then we also had a fair bit of assistance, or a lot of assistance, which was very much appreciated, from Lindsay Ewing.
Thank you, Lindsay. I went through all your stuff. I know you're interacting with Aaron more, but I went through all of it too. So what are we talking about tonight?
Tonight is an unsolved murder. It went like this. In North Carolina, 1990, a husband arrives home from work at about 10 p.m. And as he arrives to the house, he hears their 13-month-old son crying. So he goes into the home and he goes to his son's room and picks him up. And then he leaves the room. And he sees his wife's body in the dining room. Her hands are behind her back, and she has been brutally attacked. Her legs are splayed out. He says that he can tell, even though he's not close to her, he's actually a fair ways away, he says that he can tell that she is dead.
Who is he and who is she? How long they've been married?
The husband is Dr. Ed Friedland, and he's a kidney specialist. Kim Thomas and Ed Friedland met at the University of Rochester in 1979, and they were in their early 20s. They were engaged by 1982, and Kim broke off the engagement a few months later. But they got engaged again in 83, and married in 1984 in New Jersey. Now, they moved to Miami, Florida, where Friedland was a resident nephrologist. They moved to Charlotte in 86 when Friedland became the medical director of Mecklenburg Dialysis Centers. When he was married to her originally, how much was he making? He was making, what, about $70,000 a year?
Yeah, 70, I think it was like 74 to 76,000, which, you know, it's a decent amount, but for that time, it was a very decent amount.
Right, but then he continued to be successful, though, over time.
Yeah, I think he was actually, I mean, he's a kidney specialist and surgeon. He had multiple offices, and he made closer to $250,000 a year, so substantial income increase from the time they met to the time she died.
Right. And then even beyond that, it looked like his income was going to grow even more.
Yeah. He was opening up a new clinic and he was anticipating at least a $300,000 profit in the first 2 years.
Now, Kim Thomas, in 1990, she was around 32 years of age. She headed an organization known as Southern Piedmont Hours. And it's an independent adoption agency. And she also co-authored a guide for pregnant women titled A Charlotte Child, which is interesting because Kim Thomas could not conceive on her own, or with her husband, I should say. She had some sort of issue. And they tried everything you can imagine, even in vitro fertilization, and she could not get pregnant. The son that we mentioned in the summary, he was actually part of an open adoption.
Yeah.
They met the mother and she gave birth to this boy and they would take him home.
Mm-hmm.
She was also a leader in the National Organization of Women. She was the local chapter's information coordinator. You could think of an information coordinator as a spokesperson. She would take information or policies, put them out there in a way that was easy for people to digest. She would also have NOW meetings in her home. People gave her credit for being so warm and informative and caring about women's issues and women's rights.
Yeah. And her husband, he did his thing with the medical fields and opening his offices. Sounds like they were kind of going in two different directions.
Well, relationship-wise, that's what it appears. She had journals or diaries,
mm-hmm.
and these came to light later. In fact, at one point, her husband would read them in court. And it showed that over time, even early on, they had troubles, and that divorce would come up from both sides here and there over time.
Regular topic of discussion.
Right. But that seemed to die off closer to this event, because they adopt this boy.
And the diary entries turn more positive. Like, I'm so happy we have this boy. We're doing all the things we want to do now.
Right. He's becoming very successful. And Kim has this little boy, Elliot, who she just adores. In fact, one friend said that they were hanging out and Elliot had a little bit of jelly on his face. And without missing a beat, when Kim noticed it, she just picked him up, licked it off his face real quick, and set him back down and was grinning.
Mm-hmm.
She just adored this little boy.
Let's get to the day of the event here so we can kind of go over some of those details of evidence, because I think that's what really makes this story interesting. The morning of, which was July 27th, 1990, Edward, her husband, says he gets up in the morning and Kim gets up with him. They have coffee and he is seen off by her and his boy. They wave goodbye to him. There are discrepancies in the time between 7 to 7:45 in the morning, and he goes off to work. He's at work all day long and he says he doesn't get home until 10 p.m. at night-ish. And that's when he comes home and finds his wife has been brutally murdered. He calls 911. The police respond. They question him because He is the spouse. He is the last person to see her alive. This is normal police procedure, as we know. And they ask him, you know, where were you this morning? What was the last thing you did? How did you find her? They go on from there and they interrogate him for hours and hours and hours. And for the most part, he's very forthcoming with them and he tells them how his day went. I don't think they bought it though, because the investigation kind of turns more on him than anyone else at that point.
Well, there is no one else.
Yeah.
So from what I can tell though, that they were spending a lot of time really focused on just evidence in and around that property.
Yeah. So what is some of the evidence that they found here? What was this crime scene like?
Well, we should say that when they got there, they locked that place down for 4 days straight.
Mm-hmm.
And they were using floodlights inside and outside the house, illuminating as much as they could to see if there was anything to pick up, anything to find. They managed to find some evidence, but not very much.
Yeah.
So they found that whoever had committed this crime seemed to have attacked Kim when she was sleeping.
How do we know that?
Because Kim wears earplugs when she goes to bed.
And her body was found with at least one, if not both, earplugs in her ears?
She was dressed for bed when she was found. She had at least one of her earplugs still in. And her son was still in his crib. The problem here is that Kim, when she got up, she would change her clothes and her son's clothes, meaning they would get dressed for the day. They would get out of their night clothes and into their day clothes, in other words. So this doesn't really work with them having gotten up and saying goodbye to him and then somehow going back to bed.
That was their routine.
Right.
And she was handcuffed?
She appeared to have been handcuffed while she was sleeping. And then they said from the scene, it appeared as though she had been able to kick off of the bed and run out of the bedroom, and that the killer yanked on her hair and took her down.
It appears that she was attacked in bed, probably asleep, unaware. The killer was able to at least get a few good slices in. She runs, and then he tracks her down, takes her down. And whether or not she was handcuffed on the bed or off of the bed, not really sure, but she was handcuffed. And then he finished her off with some sort of knife or scalpel or some sort of sharp instrument, right?
Right. This instrument, whatever it was, some kind of a cutting tool or a knife, was never located, but it was used on her more than 20 times.
And not stabbing.
Somewhat stabbing, slashing.
Mostly slashing.
But some of the cuts did go to the spinal cord. So some of them went pretty deep.
Yeah.
So you could say somewhat cutting, but.
Yeah. But it just wasn't a stabbing motion like we would normally associate with Michael Myers or whatever.
Now, she did have cuffs on her. They were gold cuffs, or at least golden plated cuffs, yeah, or colored cuffs.
So she's handcuffed with gold handcuffs. Are they able to tie these handcuffs back to Dr. Friedland?
No. All they can say is that they know that Dr. Friedland seems to be into bondage.
This is according to his mistress and other girlfriends he had while having extramarital affairs?
Yes, this is corroborated by other people. But they can't tie those specific handcuffs to him. And even his lawyer has stated that if you can find DNA on those handcuffs, you'll have your killer. But it won't be Dr. Friedland because his DNA won't be on those handcuffs. They weren't his. And these were tested, but they yielded no fingerprints.
There was other blood placement around the house that did not have fingerprints either. So it's pretty apparent that the killer was wearing gloves, correct?
They said from the way that the blood was left in the office, especially, that it appeared as though the killer was wearing cotton gloves. Whoever did this also went into the office and was rifling through documents in drawers, but closing these drawers. So they would open a drawer, rifle through some stuff, or at least the tops of these things, and then close the drawers. Nothing was left open.
The murderer loitered around the house after the murder.
They even touched some of Dr. Friedland's clothes.
So sounds like there's a lot of blood here. Where are the bloody footprints?
Right. There were footprints. There was especially one really clear print that had a wavy tread pattern that was left in the blood.
Yeah. So they could actually see it, identify it, maybe match it with another shoe.
They had some idea of what kind of shoe it may have been as well. Dr. Friedland had a pair of rubber overshoes that he kept in the trunk of his vehicle. From what they knew of them, they likely had a very similar tread pattern. And they would make an effort to retrieve these shoes from Dr. Friedland, but he never gave them to them.
And they never followed up either.
They never followed up. They never found him. So I don't know what to make of that. It seems like if you have at least that lead, you should track it down to the end, especially in a case like this where we'll go over it some more, but they really don't have a lot.
No.
So you would think if you have something, which is these overshoes maybe matching, and I'm not saying they do, I'm saying from what they know of them, they're probably a good match. So it's worth looking into. Then they didn't look for them.
Yeah. If you could find that shoe, and if it was the same size and test it for blood, you got something there.
Another thing that happens is they use luminol, you know, in different rooms. They use it in the master bedroom sink because they said it seemed as though maybe the killer had washed blood off into that sink. The luminol test there was inconclusive. They also tested the floor with luminol. But from what I understand, they screwed up because you're supposed to use a Lumalite to check for hairs and fibers first. And by using luminol, they may have scattered or dispersed some of this evidence.
Well, then the hair fiber will muck up with the carpet, you know, with the solution. So it won't stand out later.
Now, they did collect some hairs, and most of them didn't really yield any results. And the ones that did, all they could say is they appeared to be Caucasian. Mm-hmm. They found different prints, like fingerprints, but they were not usable. Typically, that means that there are smudges.
Yeah.
Because we don't always leave perfect prints when we touch something, especially if we're moving quickly. They did find one print, but they weren't able to match it to anybody.
And if he was wearing gloves most of the time,
Right, you'd have to wonder if someone is leaving blood evidence behind that appears to have been left via a cotton glove, then why would you ever get their prints at all?
Yeah.
So you kind of have to wonder about the fingerprint evidence, as little as there is, if it's even worth anything.
What was up with the dog?
The dog was left, you could say, closed up in the master bedroom. When the killer left, they closed the dog in that room.
That's weird.
Right, and these are the questions I have. They had a security system on the house. That morning, according to what they can tell, the alarm system was not armed. It was deactivated. Kim always armed the house if she was going to bed.
There's no sign of forced entry, and there's nothing stolen from the house.
And the dog apparently didn't alert, because you would think if someone was asleep that the dog barking would wake him up. You'll say, well, if she had earplugs in, how would she hear anything? And I think that's debatable, but I've worn earplugs and I can still hear stuff. It just...
It muffles loud noises such as a gunshot and things like that, but you can still hear things. I sometimes wear my shooting ear protection to bed to muffle my wife's snoring. I can still hear her snoring. It's just not as loud.
It's a questionable thing because dogs are very protective of a home, and you have dogs, and you have little dogs. So how do you think your dogs would react if a stranger, and I think you have some experience with this, entered your home or was outside your home trying to get in?
Yeah, they alert me every day that the mailman's trying to kill me. And the mailman's actually pretty stealthy. That said, if I come home late at night, they typically don't alert. Maybe they actually know my sound, but late at night, in the middle of the night, they won't get up and do much. But I think they just know the key sound and me stepping through the door. Whereas a man with big boots or something else, they alert on nothing typically. So I'm surprised when they don't alert on me coming home, but I think they just know it's me. So nothing's stolen, and we don't find the murder weapon or the gloves or the shoes at the crime scene, and the top sheet is missing from the bed. So there's a theory that the perpetrator put all these things onto the bed and rolled them up into the bed sheet, the bloody bed sheet, and left carrying this and disposed of all these things somewhere else.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
You'd think if the killer commits this crime, takes the bedsheet with all the items inside, they can drive somewhere and find a dumpster and just shove it in the dumpster and then leave.
So this guy had enough know-how to take off his shoes, wear gloves, and bring his own knife, right? For all accounts, he was there to kill Kim because he didn't take anything. I mean, if he would have been in the middle of stealing stuff and Kim interrupted this, you know, maybe he doesn't take any of the things that he came there to steal. But this guy appeared to have murdered Kim first and then loitered around the house, right?
It's difficult to say. That's one of the questions is, did the killer take Kim to the office or did they go to the office after? But Kim was wearing jewelry, valuable jewelry.
Yeah.
So you would think the killer could have at least grabbed the jewelry that was on her.
Her purse was out. Her wallet was out. Her car keys were probably not that hard to find if they wanted to take her car.
Yeah, we don't know exactly why they had an interest in the office. We don't know. So it may or may not have been to find something in particular. We have no idea. It could have been a deceptive move. It could have been, we'll make it look like we're looking for something, but it's all just an act. It's just something for you to look at and go, oh, why were they in the office? Why were they looking at the office stuff?
And not to get morbid, but Kim's body was displayed out. Her legs were spread. It appeared as if she might have been sexually assaulted, but she was not, correct?
She was not raped, but they said that the way her legs were splayed, that it would not really have been a natural move. So someone would have had to spread her legs. And they know that someone did this because I believe it was her knee actually smeared the blood as her legs were pulled apart.
Yeah. So weird positioning of the body. Nothing stolen. Lots of questions here.
And her nightgown was hiked up past her buttocks.
Yeah. I don't know if it matters or not, but when Edward came home, he calls 911. He reports this. He doesn't go to Kim. He says from afar, he's able to see that she's dead and that he doesn't need to do CPR or try to resuscitate her. He's just calling for help. I know everyone behaves differently in a time of crisis, but I personally think that's a little odd. I would just assume that if your loved one has been injured, harmed, or whatever, even if it's totally obvious they are dead, you run to them. You hold them. You check on them. You try to administer help. Or you just simply cry over them. None of those things happen. So I think that's what kind of keyed the detectives off in the beginning, that something's wrong with this scene here.
That is his wife, but if they weren't getting along, and this is something that's possible, if there wasn't any love there, then he might not have run to her. It may have been a more complicated situation for him than just, oh my God, what happened? Now, that's where we could say, well, what about empathy? If someone you know and you've spent a lot of time with, and at this point we're talking, they were married for 6 years.
Yeah.
You would think that would be enough time that even if they had their issues, this goes beyond that. This is a murder.
Yeah.
So you would think that there would be some movement towards her. The investigators made note because they said they have to really hold these husbands back or wives back if their spouse is found dead.
Yeah.
And that goes even beyond just the initial arrival at the crime scene.
I think it's what, 4 years after the murder, they actually bring charges and go after Edward. He goes to trial.
Yeah, what would happen was there's a call to Crime Stoppers, and the person tells them that Ed Friedland was having an affair with Bridget David, who was a nurse, and he was using drugs. And so this gets the police to take another look at him. Remember, the crime scene is such that they can kind of tell what happened, but they don't really know much. There's not really enough evidence. There's no murder weapon. The shoe evidence doesn't lead anywhere. There's, you know, the DNA isn't helping. You name it. Just on down the line, there's nothing really to work with there. They even contact VICAP, which is the FBI's division. They profile and try to help you figure out what kind of person would have done the crime. And long story short, their profiles indicated either this could have been a robbery gone wrong or a crime of passion. So there's two kind of suspect profiles there. So that's what gets them refocused. And 4 years after Kim's murder, he's charged. Because they're looking at these profiles and thinking, well, we don't have any jewelry stolen. We don't have money stolen. The car wasn't stolen. So the way she was attacked was pretty vicious. And the way her body was left was very demeaning. So this looks like a crime of passion. Now, who would do that?
Well, we only have one suspect.
We have the husband who says he left, I mean, depending on what you believe, somewhere between 7 and 7:45. Most likely, you know, most of the reports that you and I've read said between 7:30 and 7:45. I got the sense it was 7:45, but, you know, it's debatable that he leaves the house. But they're saying goodbye to me and I leave.
We had coffee and they're saying goodbye to me.
Right. And when they're going through their evidence, you know, they test Kim. They test her to see if she had coffee, but it doesn't appear as though she's had coffee.
And who has coffee and goes back to bed?
Or who has coffee, goes back to bed despite their child now being up?
Yeah.
I have some experience with little children, and they don't just go back to bed like that.
No. And, I mean, and her earplugs were in. I just doubt that she got up, left her earplugs in while they made coffee with the child and said goodbye to him. Like, that just doesn't compute to me at all. So I don't think she got out of bed, made coffee, and saw him off to work. This is a huge problem I have with this.
So they decide this is their guy.
Yeah.
They need to use the circumstantial evidence. They're going to build a case against him, and they want to take him to court. But there's an issue here. The prosecutor has a forensic pathologist named Dr. Michael Badden, who is going to testify as to when Kim Thomas died.
Time of death.
And he says it's before 7:30 in the morning on that Friday.
So Edward would still have been home. Now, he used different techniques to determine time of death, and the judge wasn't moved by these?
Well, it has to do with law, I think, is what it comes down to. It's really tricky because you could think of it as, what do they consider a good method for determining time of death?
He used like eye fluid and some other determining factors.
The county, which is Mecklenburg, has a medical examiner. It's Dr. Michael Sullivan. He performed the autopsy on Kim, and he said that it likely happened before Friedland left the house for work, early morning hours. Badden said that it likely happened before 7:30 a.m., which is still at the time that Friedland should be there. And this is where everything goes wrong. Now, Badden used fluid from Thomas's eyes, as well as other information about the case provided to him to nail down a time of death.
Standard procedure stuff.
But this did not go well in court, because Friedland's defense attorney referred to it as voodoo evidence. And he says that the Charlotte Police Department, you know, coached Badden to produce that the evidence they needed to convict Friedland. So
on one side, we have seen forensic pathologists and people working in conjunction with prosecutors. And obviously time of death is fairly important in this case. But this is what the guy dictated. He used pretty standard procedures. But the defense got their point across, and the judge deemed it inadmissible.
Yeah, one of the jurors actually was talking about this and said that, you know, for Dr. Friedland to pull this off, he has to murder his wife early in the morning. He needs to have his child put back in the crib. And then he has to leave all day and leave that child there all day. Leave little Elliot in his crib from 7:45 or so all the way until 10 p.m. at night. That's a long time to leave a 13-month-old. And they described it as, it would have to be a psychopath to do that if it wasn't someone just there to rob the house who had to kill to keep their robbery secret. Although, again, as we said, nothing was stolen. But it's interesting that one of the themes or one of the storylines that keeps coming up here is, what if this was a robbery gone wrong? And a robbery is just what another suspect is the perfect candidate for. And who's that?
That would be Marion Gales. And we'll cover Marion here. Marion was a crackhead in the neighborhood that would break into homes and steal things. Marion's brother-in-law, James Roseborough, had actually done yard work for Kim Thomas and Edward at their house. And it's said that Gales probably was a hired hand and worked on their yard a few times, yet Edward has no connection to Gail's. They don't know each other. So it's possible he was there as a hired hand.
They say that he was a laborer, that he would do the odd job here and there.
Yeah. Happened to be the same morning of this murder at around 4 a.m. something. A witness named William Nobles spotted Gales walking around the neighborhood. And at 5:30 a.m., he knocked on the door of David Moore's, who happens to be the next door neighbor of Kim and Edward. David says that Gales was obviously screwed up and high out of his mind. Gales says, "I'm a police officer. Your car's been broken into, and you need to step outside for me with your car keys and fill out a report." David doesn't buy this because 5:30 a.m., disheveled man who's obviously on drugs. So David just calls 911 and says, "There's a crazy crackhead on my doorstep, and he's trying to get me to come outside or trying to gain entry to my house. You need to take care of this." So the police respond, but Gales is gone. He takes off after this situation. And according to the police, they do patrol the neighborhood for a while looking for this. And I'm sure they talk to David. And you know, when the cops come and talk to you, it's not like they just go, "Oh, is he not here? Okay, see you later." No, they stop. They pull out their notepad. They take a report. So the cops were probably there for 20 minutes-ish, but Gales was gone. Gales has a record for breaking into houses. His girlfriend would say that he probably had broken into at least 20 houses, some of which were in this same neighborhood by the time that Kim was murdered. A few of those incidents, Gail actually pulled out a gun and shot a woman and beat another woman and put her in the hospital. He's not a good guy.
He's a dangerous guy.
Yeah. And he's on drugs. That's why he robs people. That's why he breaks into houses to grab property, sell it for his drug addiction. Edward thinks, "This is the guy that killed my wife. And you coming after me or prosecuting me, you're going after the wrong guy." Because you have this Gales character who was there that morning, literally next door, and is high on crack and a problem.
And known for breaking into homes.
Yes.
He'd been in and out of prison for many years.
I think he's the perfect suspect until I think nothing was stolen, the dog wasn't killed, everything was cleaned up real nice and tidy. I don't know if a guy roaming around a neighborhood on crack has the ability to do this. But at the same time, I can't totally write him off either.
Well, there's some notes about Gales here. The prosecutor in the case against Dr. Friedland, which the charges get dismissed because Michael Badden,
The pathologist.
Yeah, he's not allowed to testify. It's inadmissible evidence.
So that's pretty much the key to the prosecutor dropping charges against Edward.
Well, it's half. The other half involving Gales is that he says when he started to see the evidence against Gales, he started to wonder why he wasn't prosecuting Gales instead of Dr. Friedland. So the prosecutor actually loses his drive to go after Dr. Friedland. One of the things that happens later with Gales that makes him an even better suspect is he ends up murdering a 27-year-old woman who was an acquaintance of his in 2008. There's a murder, so we know he can kill. But while that looks damning, again, when you go over all of the evidence, there was never any evidence that he was in the home.
No DNA, no fingerprints.
Not even the hairs found were consistent with his in color or shape or anything.
I know his girlfriend thinks that he did some really bad things and absolutely thinks that he could have done this. His brother-in-law said that he saw Gales that day later on wearing bloody clothes and that he owned a pair of handcuffs, but it's all hearsay. And I think his brother even retracted that statement about seeing him in the bloody clothes later. So,
well, and there was also in the Brown Creek Correctional Center, someone there who was, I guess you could say, housed with Marion Gales, said that Gales confided to him.
Yeah. That jailhouse snitch.
Right, that he murdered a woman. So there were indications that they had a suspect on their hands with Gales. But I would say, looking over the whole case, the one thing that, I mean, there are several things here, really, but I would say what's most important to understand why Gales doesn't make a very good suspect in the end is, one, because he was a crackhead and because he's broken into homes, they have a good MO with him.
Yeah.
They know how he acts when he's inside of a home. He's not careful about whether he leaves evidence or not. He'll leave fingerprints.
And when he shot the one lady in the arm, it was because he didn't think anyone was home. She walked in the middle of the crime. And that was his knee-jerk reaction, was to pull out a gun and shoot her.
And he still fled.
Yeah.
And he always stole stuff. Every single time he would steal something if he went into a home. He would take something.
That was his point. I would even go so far as to say his typical MO was to steal stuff and not to hurt people. The hurting people was just the reaction when he was caught in the act. At least in the early beginning times.
So the police have these two suspects. We've already talked about how Gales doesn't seem that great. But there is a tool out there that the authorities like to use, and sometimes suspects like to use to try and clear themselves.
A polygraph.
Right. So there were two polygraphs administered to Marion Gales, and there were three administered to Dr. Friedland. Now, Dr. Friedland actually requested two of those on his own by two different polygraphers.
Yeah. And they were highly regarded, lots of experience. His third and the ones that Gales did were administered by the state, correct?
Yeah. I think so. Because, I mean, let's face it, Gales doesn't have any funds.
No.
Polygraphs for Dr. Friedland were conducted on October 17th and October 29th, and then there was a third one later the same year, late fall. But the first two were found to be in his favor.
Yeah. As far as truthfulness, they say that Edward passed with flying colors when asked about the murder of his wife.
And then the third one showed deception.
But the third one was not one that he had hired the polygrapher.
Now, you've seen these conducted, right? And
yeah.
You watch the graph, and supposedly what happens is they ask you a series of questions that are test questions.
Control questions,
where they can see what kind of movement you're getting when you're responding. And then randomly, you know, they'll throw in something that's very, very taxing on you, stressful. And they'll kind of gauge where the needle's going. And supposedly, when you're deceptive, that's when
you spike.
You start spiking, and apparently that's what happened here.
But with Gale, when they asked him, did you murder Kim? It did not spike in that first test, but they said that it showed deception during the test. The second test with Gale, it did not spike when they said, did you kill her? But when they asked him, do you know who killed her? Or, you know, things that were kind of surrounding the question, that's when he failed. He kind of passed just as much as Edward did, in my mind. If you take polygraphs for any worth, which I have a friend that works for the government. He says that government polygraphs are a lot different, like as far as FBI, CIA. Those are different than state-run polygraphs or police-run. I don't know. I don't have a lot of faith in them. I think different people can read them differently, interpret the data, and different people react and respond differently. There's a whole thing called white coat syndrome, which is a real thing. People's blood pressure goes up when they go to the hospital because they're just freaked out. How can you not look at a polygraph test and say white coat syndrome wouldn't be a factor in this?
There are some stories about my mom's life that I truly never get tired of hearing. Just in time for Mother's Day, I found the perfect gift.
that captures all her stories for my family forever. It's called Storyworth. Storyworth helps you preserve precious memories and stories from your mom or grandmother for years to come. Each week, Storyworth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question that you get to help pick. What was your favorite toy as a child? Or what's your favorite memory of your grandmother? All your loved one needs to do is respond to that email with a story. After a year of responses, Storyworth compiles your loved one's stories and photos into a beautiful keepsake hardcover book. You can even keep a copy of the book for yourself. My mom completed her story, and each of her kids now has a copy to read and share with their kids. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll cherish for years. Storyworth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/GenY. That's storyworth.com/GenY to save $10 on your first purchase.
Well, the North Carolina Supreme Court said that polygraphs aren't admissible anyway.
Yeah.
And we've talked about it before. They might be useful, but since they're not admissible, they're really just to give you an idea if maybe you should keep pursuing a suspect when you don't have a lot of evidence against them. How much time do you need to waste on somebody if, say, you have a polygraph conducted by someone you trust and then they don't show any deception there? Maybe you need to move on, but I think it's just a tool. Yeah.
I think a police interrogation is a better tool. Just reading somebody with your own eyes.
I would agree with that. So Dr. Friedland makes statements. He says, you know, whoever did this is walking around free and everyone's judging me.
Yeah.
And he says things like, you know, my son and I were the ones that are the victims. She's gone. She's not suffering anymore, but we're left and I'm being persecuted. Talks about how he's having to deal with this. Yeah. And he's very upset. Once the charges are dropped, he doesn't just go away. It's almost as though he gets his offense together.
Yeah.
And he starts fighting back. What happens is he files a wrongful death suit against Marion Gales. He maintains that he's responsible.
Yeah.
And of course, in a civil suit, you don't have to really prove much. Now, let's lay it out this way. He has a great lawyer, and Marion Gales really doesn't have any lawyer.
He's sitting in prison.
He has no money.
Yeah.
He just takes what he can get.
He doesn't even care about the civil lawsuit. Why does it matter? I mean, yeah, sure, he gets to come out of his cell for, you know, maybe a week or two, but he has no interest in defending himself.
Well, Friedland wins this civil suit, and he gets an award of $8.6 million, which, of course, Gales has zero of.
Yeah.
In 1997, he sues the city of Charlotte and four police investigators for malicious prosecution. He's stating that they're going after him despite no reasonable cause for going after him. And it costs the city $4 million and 4 years of its time before the city lawyers are successful and get the suit dismissed because
they had probable cause.
As the judge says, this is a reasonable prosecution.
Yeah. So why was it reasonable? He's the spouse. He's the last person to see her alive. He is questioned. Now, during the questioning, where does he say his whereabouts are? What does he say? He says he left in the morning. And what's the problem here?
Well, the problem is he had an 8:30 appointment with a woman who ends up waiting around till about noon, and he never shows. And his office is even paging him, and he's not answering. But he's seen at other clinics throughout the day, here and there.
Clinics that he is associated with, corresponds with, works at, but he's not scheduled at any of those. He's scheduled at this one with this one woman that morning, and he doesn't show up. He's other places.
They say that's out of character, that if he has an appointment, he shows up. Or if his office is trying to reach him, he responds.
Or he cancels the appointment.
This day, he's essentially AWOL, you know, and it's not really AWOL because he's the boss, but he's supposed to be somewhere and he's not there.
And he's not notifying people where he's at. But people do see him at these other clinics or offices. So he does have witness alibi saying where he's at. It's just a break in his normal pattern.
Well, I think the worst, when it pertains to Dr. Freeland, when you look over all the evidence, to me, what stands out the most is just the idea that the alarm's not set and the dog's locked in the room, or I guess, you know, at least closed up in the master bedroom. How does he handle the dog? His wife, Kim Thomas, she appears to have been handcuffed while she was asleep because they say her manicured nails are not messed up at all. There's no blood underneath the cuffs. And with her earplugs in, as though she was sleeping when she was initially
attacked,
handcuffed, whatever. And that the fight went from the bedroom to outside the bedroom. To me, if she was actually up and having coffee, which of course the autopsy didn't show she had coffee, as far as I can tell, why would she put her kid back to bed and herself back to bed?
It's a huge discrepancy in the timeline and his explanation of the morning.
It's very questionable. There were many calls to the house from different people, from friends of hers, from a babysitter, and all these calls went unanswered.
And those started fairly early in the morning, so we know that it was a fairly small window that she was murdered in.
Right. They were happening about 8:45 on in the morning. And she had two appointments that day that she missed. One was she was supposed to take Elliot to Gymboree. And then she also had a hair appointment at 11:45. And there was to be a babysitter that was to be at the house. This is one of the most talked about unsolved cases, maybe the most, North Carolina, apart from Michael Peterson's wife's death, Kathleen, who died under mysterious circumstances in a fall down the stairs, supposedly. So these are really the two big ones in North Carolina. And this has remained unsolved since 1990. And as we talked about, he came real close to being taken to court and having to face a jury over this. But again, charges were dropped because the pathologist could not testify. It was inadmissible. And of course, Dr. Friedland's lawyer, who was also Michael Peterson's lawyer, really tried as best he could to get the police to state that he was no longer a suspect. In fact, when you look at what kind of a job that his lawyer did, he did a great job because in Florida, where he ended up moving to, there was a paper that was going to run a story about him. And his lawyer successfully got that story shelved because he argued that this would be damning for his client's business. You guys weren't able to prosecute him. You don't have enough evidence against him. How can you run a damning story like this and put this man out of work? Yeah. That's not fair. The lawyer even contacted the police and said, you know, because in 2010, supposedly some new evidence came to light. Now, we don't know what it is. There are rumors that it was touch DNA from the handcuffs, but they said they were looking at a new suspect, an unknown suspect. And so his lawyer reached out and said, hey, if you've got a new suspect, it's time to just let our guy go. You need to let him go. Say he is no longer a suspect. And the authorities said, while we're looking at a new suspect, there's no change in our
prior suspects.
Right. They would not capitulate on that. They wouldn't give in. There's still, and especially if you listen to the district attorney, even he stated that he still believes that Dr. Friedland makes for the best suspect in this case. That's where it's at.
There's no statute of limitation on murder, but they've already dropped charges against him once. Now, they drop charges, so they can recharge him if they wanted to.
Because
he didn't stand trial. It's not like a double jeopardy situation here. So I just look at between Edward and even Gales. I think we've covered enough cases where we see them charge, indict, and even get a conviction against people for less.
Yeah, but this isn't your typical suspect. Dr. Friedland has been very aggressive.
Yeah.
And while his suit against the city and against these officers wasn't successful, he still did it. And yeah, he cost the city a lot of money. So I would say there is some hesitancy there. I sense it anyway. I think they're hesitant to charge him again unless they can find something. Now, that's possible. They might have some new people look this over and they might find something, or they might get someone to come forward and give them information that points them in a, you know, in a direction where they get more leads, more evidence. But I would say the way it stands right now, you have a great suspect in Dr. Friedland, but you have where the case fell apart because of time of death. And unless they can change in terms of what the judge sees as admissible evidence, then this isn't going anywhere. It literally, I think what it comes down to is their best bet is for a judge to say, oh no, I'll accept that evidence and let's just go forward. And but that would take a prosecutor to come forward and charge him again and go take this to court.
I don't think they're going to do it. They're letting this one go. On one side, I'm happy that prosecutors aren't going after people willy-nilly and charging innocent people and throwing them in prison. But on the other side, there is a woman that's murdered here. Her family is suffering. There's no justice for them. It's a hard one to swallow on that.
It's difficult. There are cases where you feel like you can connect the dots and you find a suspect good enough that you think they should at least go to trial and let's see what happens.
Yeah.
We talked about that with Kyron Horman, that little boy who disappeared while his stepmother had him. But believe it or not, there are investigators, there are prosecutors that are out there who are more cautious and say, I'm worried that if we take this to trial now, we may not get a conviction, and then there will be double jeopardy, and they can't try him if they do get better evidence later. And that's hard because these families that are left out there suffering, and I'm not saying Dr. Friedland isn't suffering necessarily. I don't know. I'm just saying for, say, Kim's sister, Lynn, she's suffering. She would like to see some justice here. But there's that question of, do you take it to court with what you have now? Do you really push that? Or do you hope that, like they did back in 08 and 2010, that they do some more investigating and maybe something will turn up? And then you'll have a better chance of getting a conviction. So it's really tough. You don't know what to satisfy.
I get that, but are they actually doing follow-ups? Are they actually trying to find new evidence to do that conviction? And I kind of question, is this just a cold case now that has been shelved and not being readdressed?
Well, you never know what's going to happen. There are cold case detectives who come onto a case and are able to solve it later. And so you don't know if it's just, well, the right person hasn't looked at the evidence yet. This may seem crazy, but I'll walk into the kitchen and open up the cupboard and I'm looking for something. Maybe it's the next bottle of sriracha that I need to open up and I can't find it. And then the wife will come in and she'll just pull it right out of there and hand it to me and walk away.
New pair of eyes.
Right. You just never know what it's going to take to find that new evidence. But you're right. We don't know. Are they taking another look at it now? We have no idea. But we would hope that at some point they look at it again, because I know Dr. Friedland's not happy about it, but there is no statute of limitations here. His lawyer made a big stink about charging him 4 years after the fact and said, oh, that's so much time. This is ridiculous. But when it comes to murder, that's what they've said is the law. You can charge someone 15 years, 30 years after the fact.
Yeah.
So as far as my opinion goes, I can't say whether they'll prosecute Dr. Friedland again or, and here's the what if, there is that possibility, however slim some might say it is, but with all of the break-ins that occur in that area, or at least were occurring at the time, maybe the door wasn't even locked. We have no idea what Dr. Friedland said. We have no idea what
transpired right at that moment.
Right. And it's just people are left with a lot of questions, because who handcuffs a person while they're sleeping and then starts cutting at them? It's a very strange attack that occurred here and left this poor woman dead, who, as far as I can tell, has been missed by many, many people. Her death has affected many people because of how involved she was in her community. And I think from that fact alone, I think this case will probably never die. I think there are enough people that are concerned and have too many questions for it to just disappear. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.